Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. Joining me in the Korean Context studio at the moment is Ambassador John Everard, who is visiting us from Stanford University, actually. But he's the former ambassador of the UK to North Korea, and we're very honored to have him join us in the studio today. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Martha. Good to be here.
So let's jump right into the questions.
Sure.
First off, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm under the impression that the British ambassador to North Korea is a volunteer position. What made you choose to go?
Yes, that's right. In fact, in the British service, all positions are volunteer positions. You can only be sent somewhere that you've asked to go to. But I asked to go to North Korea, partly because it's exercised a long-term fascination over me, and partly, too, because I think it's one of those places where almost traditional bilateral diplomacy really can make a difference, where the difference in view between the diplomat and the host government is so big that conversations are particularly important.
You mentioned in a lecture that you delivered at Stanford in October last year that you were often questioned by North Koreans about Americans and American thinking. Because of the number of countries with formal diplomatic representation in Pyongyang is so small, did you feel that you were turned to as a representative of more than just Great Britain?
Yes, absolutely. I think that although the difference between various foreign countries is understood in the foreign ministry, that North Koreans generally tend to see the world in terms of North Korea and the rest, and you know, differences between the European countries or even between countries like the UK and the US tend to get a little bit blurred in the popular perception. The only real difference they understand is that between Russia and China on the one hand and kind of the rest of the world on the other. So I tended to get asked questions about all kinds of countries, not just the US, when I was out there. Not so much, as I say, by foreign ministry officials, but by ordinary Koreans.
Did you find that frustrating at all? Because you were there representing your country, and you know, you're not there officially to speak on behalf of anybody else.
Yes, I used to joke that I was answering so many questions about the US, I was going to demand an auxiliary State Department salary, but I never got that. No, not frustrating. I mean, clearly there were some questions that either I couldn't ask because I didn't know the country in question well enough, or that it would have been inappropriate for me to try to answer. But, yeah, you know, in the broader interests of understanding between peoples, I did what I could to shed light.
So, out of curiosity, how did you describe Americans and American thinking to the North Koreans?
Yes. You know, it's strange. When I tell Americans that I've been in North Korea, a lot of them say, wow, that must have been really, really terrible. It works the other way, you know. Before one of my various trips to Washington, while I was ambassador in Pyongyang, my resident staff kind of formed up to me and said, almost formally, you know, comrade ambassador, please don't go. So I said, well, how do you mean? And they said, well, you're going to America, that terrible, terrible country. You'll get hurt. You'll get killed. We know what it's like. But I, as you see, I've just about survived that experience too. So there are a lot of misperceptions amongst North Koreans about what life in America is really like. What did I tell them? The top level message was that Americans really don't have anything at all against North Korean people. They're not out to get them, but that Americans are very worried indeed about nuclear weapons programs and about the appalling record of human rights in the DPRK. At a kind of lower level, it's hard to describe America, even to somebody who knows a bit more about the world than most North Koreans do. So conversations tended to be focused on how immediate environments look different in America. You know, if you're standing in a bar, you might get into a conversation about how American bars look like. Not that I hang out in too many American bars, let me get that on the record. or you know, what street scenes look like, or what apartments look like, that kind of thing. You have to work from the concrete outwards, as in so many conversations with North Koreans. Yeah.
You have both said publicly and published that, quote, North Koreans are real people. What do you mean by this, and why is it important for you to say this?
I think there's a misperception, particularly amongst Americans, that all North Koreans are kind of automatons and that they all look pretty much the same, they all do the same kind of things. That simply is not true. There are very marked individual differences between North Koreans. They've all got, you know, quite strong personalities, and they all get on with individual lives, I mean, pretty much as everybody does in every country. And I think it's very important not to reduce the entire country to a cipher. These are real people we're dealing with.
What to you are... You mentioned that in North Korea, some of the people that you spoke with seem to have this slightly warped view of what life is like for Americans in the U.S. Mm-hmm. What are some of the most frustrating misconceptions that you've found that Americans have about North Koreans?
That the whole place is a prison camp. It's not. I mean, the human rights abuses are absolutely horrible, and I'm not for a moment trying to shy away from that fact. But most of the North Koreans that I knew, who tended to be kind of outer elite in Pyongyang, you know, lived lives that were materially poor by American standards, but they weren't going around in constant fear. And they certainly, you know, they had probably a wider measure of personal freedom than most Americans imagine that most North Koreans have. Also, as I've just said, the idea that all North Koreans are kind of, you know, cookie-stamped automatons. They're not. You know, they're all individuals, and they're all very different.
Your term as ambassador ended in 2008.
That's right.
Do you feel nostalgic about any aspects of your life in North Korea?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I keep catching myself missing the place, which always surprises American friends. If you have money, and that's a very big if, Pyongyang can actually be quite a pleasant place to live. Firstly, as we all know, the economy has pretty much collapsed, which means there's almost no pollution. You know, the air is fresh. You get birds singing in trees outside your window.
Well,
I never thought
about it that way.
Oh, sure, but it's there. It also means that when you go into the many Korean parks, you know, they are really, really pretty, you know, undisturbed nature. Also, I miss just the exotic sense of being somewhere so completely different as North Korea. I mean, being in America is fun, but it's it lacks that kind of wow factor.
You were in North Korea for a prolonged period of time. Did it continue to feel new while you were there, or is this just the nostalgia speaking?
It continued to feel new all the time I was there. Up until my last few days in North Korea, I was discovering new things about the country. It's one of those aspects of comments on North Korea that there's almost an inverse relationship between how much people think they know about North Korea and how long they've spent there. When I first arrived, I'd read pretty much everything I could find on North Korea, and I thought I was not exactly an expert on the country, I wouldn't claim that, but that I probably knew more than most people did. And after a few months, I started to realize that the whole areas of life in North Korea, whole bits of the way the place worked, about which I was completely ignorant. By the end of a year, I started to realize that I was actually completely ignorant about the country. And that consciousness just grew and grew and all through my time there. Also, I found towards the end of my time there that things that I thought I knew at the beginning were actually simply wrong. And I was having to correct them. And I'm pretty sure that had I been able to spend longer in North Korea, that I'd have created further impressions.
We often hear about the poverty-stricken population in North Korea, as well as the wealthy upper class that can afford to send his children to study abroad. Is there a middle class to speak of?
Yes, there is, but it's not very big, and it's concentrated almost entirely in Pyongyang, the kind of outer elite, the people who have, I suppose you'd call the United States white-collar jobs, live in apartments that most Americans would regard as impossibly cramped, but which are much more comfortable than some of the accommodation elsewhere in the DPRK, and who don't get to eat everything that they would like every day, but on the other hand, don't normally go hungry. There are quite a lot of these people, and their loyalty, or lack of it, I think will be crucial to the regime's survival.
Now, I hear that you've done a little bit of exploring of the country on bicycle. Would you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm a dedicated cyclist. and in real life, I spend a lot of time sort of doing cycle campaigning, but let's not take this time of this interview talking about that. I was able to cycle within Pyongyang. The rule is that you can cycle, or you can walk, or take any other form of transport you like, up to 35 kilometers from central Pyongyang.
From the center of Pyongyang.
That's right. Okay. I never worked out what there was meant by the center of Pyongyang, but anyway, that's what the rule book says. In practice, what happens is you can go up to the first ring of military checkpoints, and you will stop there. Cycling around Pyongyang is fairly straightforward in terms of the politics of doing it. The big problem is the amazing Pyongyang one-way system. You have to sort of work out which streets go which way to be able to navigate the city. And there are areas where you're not allowed to cycle. You are not, for example, allowed to cycle along the road that takes to Kumsusan, which used to be Kim Il-sung's palace. It's now where his body lies embalmed, as cycling is regarded as disrespectful to the president for life. Outside Pyongyang, I cycled, was it twice or three times, to Nampo, the port, and other people actually managed to cycle out towards the east, out towards Wonsan, but I never actually attempted that.
Whether on bicycle or on foot or however, how freely were you able to walk around the city or to explore the city itself?
Absolutely. Absolutely free. I mean, if you are a resident foreigner in Pyongyang, I'm sure that the security services keep a watchful eye on you, but they don't actually stop you walking around. And provided you don't do anything like attempt to photograph anything sensitive or try to get in anywhere that is clearly off limits, then you can wander around to your heart's content.
How much access did you have to your counterparts in the North Korean government?
I had good access up to roughly the level of vice minister to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Access to other government departments was erratic. I got access when I had specific business I needed to conduct with them. The problem, though, is that you asked about my counterparts. Of course, that means the actual state civil administration. They aren't really the people who run North Korea. North Korea is run by the party and by the military, and which of those two is actually pulling the strings at any given moment is something that North Korea experts spend a lot of time arguing about. I got access to the party administration on two or three occasions during my time there, but it was quite rare and took a lot of setting up. And to the military, only at really quite low level. You realise who really has power in North Korea when you call on the party. Calling on the Minister of Foreign Affairs is relatively straightforward. I mean, the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Pyongyang is right next to Kim Il-sung Square, and you drive past it any day of the week. The headquarters of the International Secretariat of the Korean Workers' Party is within what is called the Forbidden City, the part of Pyongyang that doesn't show on any maps, which is actually blocked off to the common masses, where the senior elite have their offices. And it means getting special permission and having to go through a special roadblock and go through various other controls to get into this really quite different and rather privileged area of the city.
Did you find that while you were in Pyongyang, you had a good grasp of the politics around you, or did you rely on contacts outside of the country to give you information about what was going on in the North Korean government?
You need to know, you need to have access to outside information. The bit of information you can pick up within Pyongyang is gold dust. It's eyewitness accounts, and it's firsthand from the North Koreans. And I realized that it was anything I could pick up was greatly appreciated by the international community. But there's not a whole lot of it. And to this day, most of what I know about the overall structures of North Korea, I know from external sources.
Now, we all know that there's a lot of activity currently in the North Korean leadership, especially in preparation for a change of the leader sometime in the next few years. Did you see a loosening of control by the North Korean government while you were there? Did you see any sort of grassroots resistance from the side of the people?
I wouldn't say. There was some loosening of control while I was there, but already when I arrived in 2006, controls were nothing like as tight as foreigners tend to imagine. Mm. You see quite widespread disobedience of the police. The frog markets, which I'll be talking about in my presentation in a little while, are of course entirely illegal, and yet they were set up day after day by thousands of women across the country, a mass act of civil disobedience. And talking to ordinary North Koreans, you didn't get the sense that the police were held in any great awe anymore. I mean, everybody knew that if you stepped out of line, then nasty things would happen to you. But there wasn't, you know, the kind of terror of the police that there used to be in some of the more authoritarian regimes of Eastern Europe, for example.
Would you please discuss a little bit of what daily life was like for the foreign diplomatic community there in Pyongyang?
It's like living in a village. I arrived after what I call the Great Cull, when the DPRK authorities threw out most of the non-government organizations, most of the not-profit organizations that worked in there, so that there were many, many fewer foreigners in early 2006 than there had been in late 2005. And the few that were left tended to band together. Everybody knew everybody else, and everybody knew everybody else's business, and all the good and the bad aspects of a small community, kind of, you know, small-town America writ large, if you know what I mean. The exceptions were the Russian and the Chinese embassies, both of which are huge compared to all the other diplomatic missions. I think either the Russian or the Chinese embassy is actually larger in terms of total staff than all the other embassies rolled together. And they tended to keep themselves to themselves, not because they were being antisocial, but simply because, you know, if you're surrounded by so many Chinese and so many Russians, you know, you've got your social life built in, as it were. That's although the Russians were always generous with what they had, and I used to go every Sunday morning and play football at the Russian embassy. They had a kind of a football ground there we used to kick a ball around on.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Otherwise, you have to make your own entertainment. I think a lot of us became quite expert on world cinema. You know, a lot of DVDs get watched. We threw parties. Every now and then people would organise a quiz. And, of course, there's the famous RAC, the Random Access Club, supposedly the most exclusive club in the world, because to join it you have to be a foreign resident of Pyongyang. And it's held in the downstairs of what is now the World Food Programme building, used to be the Bulgarian Embassy. A little before I arrived, it used to be so busy on Friday nights that you had to kind of stand in line to get a drink. After I arrived, it was often empty, even on Friday nights, though so many foreigners had gone. But it's still there, still fighting on.
Now, lots of people are predicting North Korea's impending collapse. What is your sense of the actual viability of the North Korean regime? Are we seeing its end, or are people anticipating a collapse that may not come?
I think that a lot of people are still smarting from having had their fingers burnt for predicting the collapse of the regime at the depths of the famine in the 1990s. Of course, they've been proved wrong. And there's a certain reluctance amongst the Korea-watching community to predict collapse now, in case you get even more egg on your face. But it's quite clear that the regime is in a bad way. It's going through a transition which appears problematic for various reasons. It's facing acute economic problems, and it's facing, in particular, an erosion of the information blockade with which it surrounded itself for many years. The outer elite in Pyongyang do now know a great deal about what goes on in the outside world. They know that almost all the countries that surround them are a great deal richer than the DPRK, and they know that what they were told during the famine of the 1990s, that, you know, the famine was bad in the north, but that all the oppressed brethren in the south were even worse state, that was simply a lie. So that the regime's legitimacy amongst these people is being eroded. When will the regime finally fall? That is very difficult. We're in the same kind of situation as we were in the last days of the Soviet Union. Almost every Western analyst had worked out that the Soviet Union was an arithmetical impossibility. It simply could not go on as it was. But nobody got the timing of its collapse right. And it's worth remembering that the immediate cause of the collapse was something completely obscure. It was Hungary opening its border to East Germans to go across into Austria. So, you know, a shot out of the blue. And I think it's quite possible that the end of the North Korean regime will come in the same kind of way. In many ways, North Korea is a bit like a drunken man walking along a road strewn with banana skins. Now, he may be able to walk for some way longer. It's unlikely that he can walk for very much longer without treading one of those skins. But how far he can walk, which of those skins is finally going to cause him to topple, really, we're guessing.
Ambassador Everard, it's been a true pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
For more information about this episode, this podcast, and upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.